Welcome to The Last Supper, your weekly podcast about art in Asia. I'm your host, Oscar Venhuis. Every weekend I sit down and release an episode bringing new perspectives and engaging dialogues with emerging and established artists, galleries, curators and collectors in Asia. Learn more about art in Asia with Christie's Education in-person and virtual art courses, gallery visits and webinars. Visit Christie's Education website and enter all in capital letters LASTSUPPER15 to enjoy a 15% discount. The website link and discount code for Christie's Education can also be found in the description of this podcast. I sat down with artist Serene Hui and we delved into meaning making, the impossibility of communication in an unknown environment, the origins of scold, gossip and siren. We also discussed voice modulation, or how we understand voices within our body and how this impacts female leaders. Hello Serene, welcome back to Hong Kong and thanks for stopping by Sheng Wang. And how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. I am a little bit tired from, it has been this few years. Every time I come back to Hong Kong, I always go through like a huge illness, but somehow it makes me feel like home. Like if I get sick, I feel like, I know I'm back at home again. I don't know, it's a strange feeling.
That's a curious experience. I haven't heard that before. Now, I know that you considered many places to study, but somehow you ended up in the Netherlands. Tell me more about this journey.
I did 1 year of an exchange students in Malmo in Sweden. So at that time I started this, this affiliation with the Scandinavian culture and the weather, in general, the culture of the North. And somehow I got back to Hong Kong and I started working. And a few years ago when I started planning for postgraduate, because I always think that I wanted to study more. And I was just researching about where should I go to study. And at that time I was working in a commercial gallery. So I feel like I want to escape from this, gigantic economic system where art is really not prioritized. So I was thinking where to go. And I suddenly remember a few years ago, I went into an art residency in Rotterdam. I totally don't remember anything about that. I mean, I'm very forgetful. Like I forget a lot of things. And I just suddenly remember a friend whom I met in the residency recommended a course named Artistic Research. And at the time, I think back then in Hong Kong, it was not that common for people to conduct field works or like do research-based projects. I mean, nowadays I see a bit more of people going to that path. But then a few years ago, I don't think it was a very common approach for Hong Kong artists or in general in Asia. It's not a trendy subject. So I was thinking, it seems like I wanted to learn a bit more about the theories or to practice some of my writing skills and the idea of how do I articulate better with my concepts and how do I, organize research materials and stuff before I do any projects. So I thought artistic research could be something helpful to me. And at the end, I applied for this course in The Hague in the Netherlands for artistic research as a postgraduate. And I ended up there. And after that, I sort of like stayed in the Netherlands. And until 2 years ago, actually, a friend invited me to go to Oslo for another film production. And then because it was COVID and all sort of reasons that I haven't been traveling for some years. And when I arrived in the Oslo airport, I remember the first impression is just, wow, I actually remember some of the Scandinavian languages, because when I was in Sweden, I studied a little bit and I thought, wow, I forgot that it was my like very original or, this initial idea of going to Scandinavia instead of Holland. But then somehow I choose Holland because I thought, Scandinavia, I'm not really sure. I really liked it, but I'm not sure about the art education, or it seems like it's more famous for design and architecture, or less people talk about this is art at that time. So I thought, well, maybe I can choose a place close enough to Scandinavia, but not exactly in Scandinavia. Then I thought, Netherlands, yes, by proximity is closest.
But then again, Germany is very close to Scandinavia and could have been an option as well.
True, but I'm always this kind of person who goes a little bit off from the mainstream. So like, I know that a lot of people fantasize to go to Germany. And when I was in bachelor, a lot of friends also studied German. But I also did actually 1 year of German, thinking that maybe someday I would go to Germany. But after learning that everybody wants to go to Germany, I'm somehow like, yeah, then I would go to a place not far from it, but not exactly there. I'm always like in between the mainstream and the indie, I would say.
So I haven't lived in the Netherlands for almost 20 years. And to give more context to your background, but also to your work, I'm curious what attracted you to study art in Europe and not in, let's say, Australia, South America, or even the US?
I think one of the reasons is that, of course, nowadays, if people think of where to go, like for immigration or travel, people mostly choose a place where you understand the language. And for me, this is exactly why I don't want to go to any English-speaking countries. I always wanted to, because my brother's in London, actually. So somehow it makes sense that if I also go to London. But no, for me is that I wanted to be in a place where I don't understand what people are saying. And I think that is important for me. I need this distance of understanding a little bit or just enough to survive, but not go into deeper level of overhearing what people are saying on the metro, or like if I walk in the street, I have this consciousness of I can choose to listen or not to listen to what the conversations around me are.
And why is that?
Maybe in Hong Kong, I feel like it was, I'm speaking about this in the perspective of before I moved. So I feel like for a lot of people, including myself, that Hong Kong is so dense and is so busy, and you always have a very compact life every day. Wherever you go, into shopping malls, transportation and everything, you're so close to everybody else around you. And I think I'm a person who needs a lot of distance between not only people, but also to anything that I want to experience. I feel like keeping a distance makes me more clear, allows me more room to fully observe what it is happening. So like if I'm on the metro, if I'm in my daily life and it's so easily that I would take in what people are talking around me, it somehow annoys me. So like I somehow feel like, let's say on the metro, I don't want to see what your phone is reading. You know, I just, it's just accidentally I peek into your phone and I see that what article you're reading, or like what news you're watching, or like what social media you're watching. And I feel like, no, I don't want to be so connected, or in a way it's a strange connection that you don't actually know the person, but then you feel like I understand a little bit of your life, and somehow it makes me feel like I don't want to be this intruder of strangers in my environment.
Is it fair to say that you have the impression you invade someone's privacy by overhearing or reading what they read?
Because I'm a very analytical person, I would say. So like if I overhear a conversation of someone speaking on the phone, or you know, when they're arguing, I would have immediately like 10 options in my head. What should I respond, or like how should I do, or like I would start to think of maybe I should help, maybe I should not, or you know, why are the people around them didn't react to what they're doing, or like, and then I would start to think a lot of how me as individual, or like if I just expand the topic into, you know, thinking about socio-political implications. So I feel like somehow it distracts me a lot if I receive all this information daily through all different kind of sources. So I wanted to keep, that's why I create this distance for myself, where if I wanted to know something, I go for it, rather than constantly being fed with unnecessary or like anything unfiltered, because it doesn't necessarily do good to my thinking.
It's kind of really fascinating what you just said there, because I have tried to explain this to other people as well. I don't speak Cantonese and I have a similar experience as you in the Netherlands, but I find it kind of, I'm not sure what the right word is, but I am unable to overhear conversation in Hong Kong. So in most cases, I have no clue what people are saying because I don't master the Cantonese language. Maybe a few keywords. And of course, I can see people's body language, and hear the intonation, but I would not have a clue what they say to me in detail. Of course, I notice they are angry, and yet not understanding a spoken language offers me a kind of solitude in the chaos and really busy lifestyle of Hong Kong. So far, I find it quite nice and calming not to understand people in Hong Kong. Of course, it has its disadvantages and drawbacks. But my question for you is what your experience of this is in the Netherlands, of learning the language and not being able to understand them.
I think I made an active choice of not learning the language. I mean, in the first few years, I really feel like, no, I don't need Dutch because everybody speaks English. And yeah, I just don't feel the necessity to really master the language. But I did went to a few Dutch learning courses, but it was epic failure almost every time. Because, well, in the first 2 years while I was studying, actually, I was so overwhelmed by studies and courses in the postgraduate school. So I don't really have a regular time where I can really look into the language books and stuff. So I went to a few classes and I dropped it off because I feel like if I'm not spending enough time on it, I'm not going to succeed. So why do I waste the time? So, and after that, after graduation, I was already thinking, well, maybe if I wanted to be, well, let's put it this way, because I have friends who also moved to Europe, to Germany, let's say, and I have a really good friend who moved to Germany where she go there by herself and she picked up the language only with Duolingo, this app. And I also used it. Actually, I think the time where I learned most Dutch is that during the past 3 years, during COVID, it's just lucky that I get the chance to come back to Hong Kong for exhibitions and shows. And every time I have to go through this quarantine, and I'm this person who went through every single quarantine measure. So like I went for 14 days in the first year, and in 21 days I did it. And then lastly, the 7 days, I also did it. So every time is during quarantine where I spend so much time on Duolingo and I pick up most of the Dutch language because I really don't know what to do in the hotel room. So I'm just actively learning Dutch at that time. And I also register for like Zoom classes for Dutch. But it was actually really the idea when I start to think of now that I'm out from the academic system and I'm living as an individual in society, maybe I need to be a bit more involved in the surroundings. And I think it's a scary part for me because if you think of since you're young, when you grow up, you're constantly being put in any systems, like in schools, in work situations, you never stops. But then I think it was that moment when I really realized that it's a choice half voluntarily, that I made a choice for myself that I ended up in a totally new, unfamiliar society where I have to think of my role or like I have to position myself in this place where if I don't do anything, no one is going to, you know, assign me to any positions as an immigrant or like as someone who ended up in another culture. You can be invisible. Sometimes if I think about it, I start to be paranoid. It's like if I woke up and if I do nothing of the day, in the day, I really can be an invisible person here. So nobody knows that I exist. And what should I do in this society then? So I thought maybe I should learn the language. Not that I need to master it, but at least if I go into any occasions, I can maybe understand a bit or comprehend a bit more. Yeah, and maybe from learning the language, I can understand a bit more how this society works, how people think. But I mean, as I said, it was an epic failure because every time I registered to a course, I ended up going somewhere else for work or like traveling somewhere else. So like I never really managed to finish a full course. And I remember I was traumatized when I registered for like a really proper Dutch language course because it's like this course organized by the municipality where you can register for a really low price. And it's not for students. Like obviously it's for people who moved to the country and wanted to you know, really live a life there. So there are adults and there are people who have maybe been here for some years, or, you know, they are not fresh, you know, immigrants that who just arrived and wanted to learn the language. And I don't know why I enrolled in this course, because it says it's beginner. So I thought, okay, I can learn. And then when I arrived in the first class, it was like 20 people. And one thing that I really like about the class is that the teacher refuses to use English at all. So like, since the first step I go into the classroom, she doesn't speak any English. So like, she just keep on going with Dutch. So even if you don't understand, she doesn't care. So you just repeat what she's saying in Dutch. And luckily, after a few years, I can pick up some words. Like I can never fully comprehend the sentence, but I know a little bit of the keywords. So I sort of can guess what she's saying. But then I remember when she asked the class to, you know, introduce yourself, like tell us what your name is, where you come from, how long have you been here in Holland, and what you're doing. I mean, to my surprise, all my classmates, they can at least, I mean, maybe they're speaking broken Dutch, which I would not know. But then for me, they all can explain in Dutch what they're doing, how long have they been here, what their hobby is even. And I'm like, wow, this is definitely not beginner. And when it's my turn, I was really like this for 5 minutes. And then when the teacher helped me, and I think she asked me like, what's your job? Because in the class, people mostly do a pretty ordinary jobs, like work in the office, or as a clerk, or, you know, as an IT officer and something like that. But then I was hesitating if I should speak of my occupation as an artist, which at that moment I didn't know what to respond. And I said artist, and of course it arrives all these questions of artists. What kind of art do you do? Do you paint? Do you do sculptures? And I have also, like, I don't really speak any of this Dutch language, and I was really trying so hard to explain my art is more conceptual. I do a lot of research, and it's mostly, you know, as an installation format at the end, and it's not like a single piece of, not anything that looks like a commodity that you can buy in a gallery. And it's so hard. And then after that class, immediately I tell myself, next time if anyone asks me about what my occupation is, never say artist. Like, just made up something else. Don't get myself into this complex situation where you have to explain what art is, what you're doing, and how do you, you know, what approach do you do with your art. And yeah, it was such a and after that course, I was traumatized in going into any beginner language course. I was like, no, if before I go into any beginner courses, I have to at least learn on my own for a year.
I have a similar experience. However, I am not traumatized by it. And I've come to terms that I will never be able to fluently speak Cantonese in Hong Kong. And at times, I am probably slightly embarrassed by it. But simultaneously, I can do everything I need with my English language skills. And you have decided something similar.
Because everybody speaks English in Holland. So basically, if you're not really going into a job interview or something, you basically don't need Dutch in your daily life. You go into the shops, people also speak English, simple English. Or anywhere you go, people at least know like basic English. But maybe it's also one of the reason why, because after that, when I reflect on this few years life in the Netherlands, sometimes I feel like I have really, maybe it's part of the reason is that I don't speak the language, that makes me feel like I've never really been in a very deep conversation with anyone else in the country, except for the art events. Apart from talking about art, I don't feel like I have been in a very, well, not that it's not genuine, but it's not as deep as what I used to have with friends here in Hong Kong, like a conversation which is always a bit on the surface. But somehow, this is how I imagined my life also in the Netherlands. Like I sort of know that I ended up in another place and I need this space for myself where I can be mostly focusing on my own thinking. And if I need it, I can go into interactions with people around me, but not fully immersed in a particular community.
I have a small favor to ask that will make a big impact. The Last Supper is offered to you at zero cost. And if you like this show about art in Asia, give this podcast a star rating or subscribe to this podcast channel. Many thanks and let's continue. I was reading your biography that you sent to me, and if you don't mind, I'm going to quote directly from that. So, Serene's work is involved in a discursive, artistic and political exploration of her own context, using the geographical distance from personal lived experiences to investigate the wider social political impact of how meaning is made and who has access to making it, end quote. So I'm interested in the process of how we make meaning, or the semiotics of this. What can you say about how meaning is being made?
I think by that, I mean language. So like I would say, most of my works deal with languages. And before, it was more focused on the textual context, like the languages of the vocabulary. But more and more, I think of, I also, maybe for this year or for current works, I'm thinking more of the sonic part as well. But then when I wrote this statement, let's say, I was thinking about how we understand languages. So I feel like, yeah, I think we had this good start of talking about languages and communication, because deep down, I feel like my works always have to deal with communication, indirect or direct, or like, let's say, the possibility of or impossibility to communicate. And the idea of translation, how do you translate from one thing to another thing? And it is through this communication and using words to communicate, it makes meaning. So like each, I always like this idea of each word is like a world making. So it depends on what you say and how you say it. It has a very different perception. And always is this gap between the person who speak and the person who listen. So you can never fully deliver what you want to say, or even you cannot actually fully translate what you're thinking from your head to your mouth. And when the person who hears it, they will never be able to fully understand what you're saying. And I feel like all these gaps in between fascinates me. And I feel like art sometimes comes in this kind of gaps, and or maybe for my own works, I like to think of these gaps or like these traces of what is being said or what is being silence, and things that are maybe that doesn't have an existing vocabulary for it.
You talked about the impossibility of communication. Can you speak more about this and how you use this in your work?
I always try to pick up words or like languages from my own lived experience. So like I always like to think of the language that I use to speak, Chinese or Cantonese, and the language that I encounter, let's say in some other places, or English as an so-called universal language. But I, you know, it's a heavily coded language for English especially. Well, maybe I can give you an example of one of the recent projects. And this is how I play with this idea of, you know, semiotics and languages and ideas behind. So in one of my recent projects, it's called Scold, Gossip and Siren. So these three words actually maybe give you a little bit of background information. So like when I first do this project, it was part of this under an exhibition with Parasite last year. It's called The Scientific Witchery. And in this exhibition, we wanted to look into the idea of, you know, what is scientific and what is the opposite of science? And what do we mean by, you know, having this alternative knowledge or anything that is not in a dominant understanding or is not authorized, I was thinking the word. So I was looking into this witch hunt history. It doesn't really speak so much to Asian or like the Eastern culture, but while I was in the Netherlands, it was sort of a trendy topic, and I got really fascinated about the history behind it. I mean, at that time, I was not very superstitious, or like, I was just really interested in how this witch hunt history grew around the 14th, 15th century in Europe, and as a byproduct of a society which is stepping into a more capitalistic agenda. So it was all about this marginalization, or it's mainly about this discrimination to women in society at that time. And witches actually is a term that used to, you know, to talk about women who are idle or like not productive for the society, where at that time they are aiming for a more, you know, industrial capitalistic approach. And I found these three words through my researches: scold, gossip, and siren. Actually, siren is not so much directly related to the history, but scold and gossip, they are. So basically, scold, we understand the word now, it means like I yell at you, or like I, you know, blame you for something you've done wrong. So I scold you for something that you did badly. But the word, the origin of it, words itself from Latin, is means scold. It means like someone who speak in the public in a loud voice, or like in a voice where it's not controllable, or like is, let's say if you're weeping, you're crying, or you're screaming in public environment, you're, especially for women. So like any women figure who are not controlling her voice or her way of speaking in a public situation, she's called a scold. But it was a more neutral connotation. So it was not as bad as now we understand scold. And gossip, now that we understand it worse, it has a very bad connotation, where we talk behind people's back as something that we do, you know, to attack, or you speak about something badly of another person. But then the origin of the word comes from godmother. So interestingly, in the Latin origin of this word, gossip means godmother. And how does it become what we understand gossip now is that because of this tradition where at that moment, maybe around 14th, 15th century, if you have a newborn baby in your family, you always have this elderly or like this aunt or grandmother who comes to the household and to teach the newborn mother, how do you take care of the baby? What do you do with, you know, domestic labor and stuff? And the way that they speak, they're mostly very soft and intimate. So they're always like this image where a group of women gather together and they speak in a very intimate way, and sometimes they giggle, or you know, they have a way of speaking where the man thinks that they're making idle talks or like bullshits, and it irritates them. So that's why it becomes gossip as we understand the word nowadays. And through this project, what I did is that it was actually a very complicated project where this three parts of the word, scold, gossip, and siren. Later on, I would go into the idea of siren. But then each part of the word is a very different constellation of elements. So like in scold, it was two channel video where I mainly asked about the question, what does it mean to train your voice? What do we do when we wanted to go through like a voice modulation? And deep down from this idea is that I was looking at, it was a bit sensitive when I talk about it, because a few years back then we have this female chief executive in Hong Kong, and a lot of people commented about her presentation in speeches and stuff, like the way that she speaks, or actually not only her, but in general, when there's a female politician or like any female figure in power, people always judges how they speak or like how they present themselves in the public. And a lot of them, especially for politicians or celebrities, they have this voice training sections before they actually, you know, go on the stage or like present themselves in the public. So what does it mean to actually change someone's voice, or like how do you train your voice? So is your body only an instrument, you know, like is your voice also as a tool for you, or how do you see your voice and your body as one or as different entities? So like for the part scold, it's mainly this two channel video where one part is a video essay where I gather different, you know, examples of pop cultures or politicians, with, let's say, Margaret Thatcher, this iconic politician, where she has go through like a voice training section. Even her voice trainer sometimes was being interviewed about how he trained Margaret Thatcher before she actually gave a public speech. So it was a video essay about that, like how do you, what do you do, or how do you see voice training or voice modulation? And the other channel of the video is that I personally go through a voice training section in the Netherlands. It happens to me that a friend recommended me to go to, well, before I actually went to visit this master, so his name is Jean-René Toussaint. He's a French theater actor, producer, and he has been active in the theater scenes for many years, and he's now at his 76 or 77 years old. He's a pretty old master in, you know, acting and voicing. And actually, after he retired from his theater work, he has his own studio which specialized in focusing on voice training. And his methodology is that your voice is, or how do you use your own voice, it reflects so much on how you think or how do you connect yourself to the society. So that's why his exercises or his, you know, so-called training actually is helping you to shape or to find your own voice. So in Dutch, his workshop is called a stemwerk, so it's primitive voices. So it's all about how do you understand the voices within your body, or how do you, you know, discover what voices you have within your own capacity. So this is the other part of the, it's more like a documentary, a short film where I go to his classes, and I actually still go regularly. Almost every month I attend his classes where we look into how we voice and how we speak, and or in general, how do we resonate? Because it's so much about not only speaking, but also listening. And this is the first part of the really complicated project. In the first exhibition that was shown, that was last year in the with Parasite in the Medical Science Museum, and then it was shown again in Rotterdam earlier this year. And then last month, while I was in Seoul for a residency in the MMCA, it was also shown there. And I think next year it's going to some other places.
And what has been the feedback from the audience you have spoken with in these different places?
They were all very out of courtesy. A lot of people really appreciate it, which I also really appreciate that. But I think I remember last month in Seoul, they also told me about how one of the audience who was in the exhibition also come to me and say, like, because a huge part of the video has this references to Margaret Thatcher and excerpts from the film The Iron Lady. So it was obviously talking about female politicians who went through, you know, voice training sessions, and it changes how the way that she presents herself and people perceive her as, you know, a more masculine or more, you know, powerful leader in like a role in society. And I remember this Korean audience who came to me and said, well, actually, it reminds me a lot of this because they also had a female, how do you call it, minister, chief executive back then. And people have so much comment about the way she speaks also in on the news. And every time she gives a public speech, either she is pretending to be a masculine figure, or like the way that she speaks is so robotic or, you know, lifeless. It's obviously that she's reciting what she has learned to speak instead of speaking from her heart, which I think it happens to a lot of politicians. But then the other time, she's either in this, you know, very strong representation, or she would cry in front of the camera because maybe she feels like people empathize her more if she exposed this other part of herself as a, you know, very soft and female in society. But it's also these two extremes where people misunderstood the voice of a feminine quality. So I think it's an interesting conversation where I have with this Korean audience, where how do we define feminine voices? So like, it doesn't necessarily mean that a female voice is feminine, or like feminine voices is that any sounds that we consider them as not moderate or not controllable or like not in any common speed or emotions that we expect to have in a dialogue. But then it also somehow means that we take out a lot of emotions, or that we take out a lot of the parts that are nonverbal. And they always constitute to a more richer, a more animalistic way of speaking. And most of the time, these sounds or these voices are considered feminine, and they're less acceptable or like less preferable in society, because we all wanted to have more, you know, productive, or let's say just now we talk about we were impatient. So we wanted to have everything just on point, and we don't really look into the details or like all these subtle nuances when we communicate.
What's fascinating about producing a podcast and meeting so many people like yourself over the last few years is that we, and I am generalizing here, that many creative people talk about multiple topics and are very comfortable to divert from the subject while also making connections between seemingly or apparently unrelated domains during the conversation.
I know. Maybe that's why also sometimes I find myself a bit crazy, like doing research work, especially with all my works. It's a lot of text. It's heavily text-based and with a lot of references and literature materials. And I think I did a good job in organizing all this material to make them look like they are organized. Because for me, I think a lot of my work, how I consider making art, is that I have all this very different or like similarly unconnected or like, yeah, very different materials, but I managed to find, you know, nuances and similarities between them or like subtle meanings that connect them together. And this is how I normally plan for my works. So like maybe, let's say for Scold, Gossip and Siren, they are like three very different words, but then somehow I look into what they have in common. And from there, they're all about quality of voices or like, you know, the sonic part of how we speak. It's all about speaking and making sounds. And I put them together as one project. And I feel like this is how I normally think in my daily practices.
What I noticed while producing this podcast is that it is easier to make a mistake when we talk. In fact, we often misplace words, or I do that at least, and make grammatical errors when we speak. And most of the time, we still understand what the other person is trying to say, even with the errors. But when we write or read a text, every mistake appears to be a lot more pronounced, and it can really hinder how we understand it. At least for me, I don't have a problem when people speak broken English to me, whereas if it is a written piece with many mistakes, somehow I find it a lot more difficult to understand.
But I think it's also this opacity that is allowed when you're speaking, like, you know, verbally, because in writing, apart from poetry, you always look for consistency, you look for clarity. But then when you're speaking, maybe because you don't see the full picture, and because if you're reading, you somehow, you know, your eyes can see, you know, how long is the essay, like what is in front or after each sentence. But then when you're speaking, you don't think that way. You're looking really into the moment where you speak of that sentences, and you let go of this idea of, you know, to be coherent, to be, you know, forming a bigger picture which is presentable, and you're totally just going with the flow when you're speaking. Normally, I think for most people, you don't think of what I said 5 minutes ago or like what I'm gonna say in the next 5 minutes, so you don't have this pressure of making a good story. And I think maybe this is the beauty of verbal languages.
Now let's talk about another work that you made in collaboration with Lam Lai in Hong Kong for Tycoon. The work is called Through the Glass Darkly. What can you say about this?
This is part of the sound form programs by Contemporary Music in Hong Kong and Tycoon Contemporary. But it was not my own solo project. I worked with Lam Lai, Lee, her English name is Lee, and she's an electronic musician. And she's also based in The Hague in the Netherlands, so that's why how we collaborated. So for that project, actually, it really goes into more the core concept of communication. Because for the past other projects, I always somehow deal with the idea of communication, but not directly talking about communication. So for this invitation for sound forms, I thought maybe I could really let go of a lot of references and other people's quotation. That's how I normally work. And I really try to formulate my own text or like my own saying in this project. So actually for sound forms, is, well, maybe I give a little information about the work itself. It's meant to be a sound piece with 8-channel audio setup. And the whole program runs about 2 hours. And it was supported by a libretto where I wrote the script. And I invited a few people to record the libretto including me, myself. So there's four protagonists in this script, and it was loosely connected. It's not like a fictional story where there's a, you know, beginning and end and plot. It was like a monologue performed by different people, but they all at the end speaks as the same person. So it's more like an immersive situation where you enter into a space and you have all these eight channels, soundscapes coming from different speakers, and you have a video, a film that is an abstract visualization of the script. And basically the whole idea is to look into what sounds is, what voices are, and how do we understand this idea of the impossibility or possibility of communication. So the script itself, there's three main stories, let's say. One is inspired by this film, or it's actually from a book. It's adapted from a book called Diving Beyond the Butterfly. I don't know if you watched it, but it's a true story by this French Elle magazine editor who passed away in the 90s. And he is one of this person who has this rare neuro disorder called Locked-in syndrome. So basically, for any patient with Locked-in syndrome, you're close to a vegetable. You lose all the muscle strength. You just, the only thing that you can move within your body is your eyes. So like, they can only blink. For a lot of patients, I mean, like, there are some other cases where people can also tilt their head a little bit, but then mostly is that they cannot move except for eye blinking. So for this editor, he had this rare syndrome, and from there, he worked with a speech therapist in the hospital, and they developed a way, like I would call it an alternative way of communication, where they hold a tablet with all the alphabets, but the alphabets are arranged in an order of frequency of speaking. So like, it's not A, B, C, D, E, but it depends on, it's like E, S, Q, so it depends on the alphabets that we frequently used. And every time the speech therapist would hold the tablet and read out all the alphabets, and the way that he can formulate a word is that he blink. So every time, if he hears the alphabet that he needs, he blink. And from there, he made up words and then sentences, and eventually he wrote a book. And I found it really inspiring. And I remember it was one of my favorite films when I was in high school, because I have this, somehow there's this DVD at home. My father is a collector of all these old movies. So that's why I remember this film a lot, and I found it really moving and how inspiring of how we can communicate even without speaking, because we depend so much on, you know, dialogues, conversations and stuff. But then this is such a beautiful way of imagining an alternative way of communicating to the world, or communicating within yourself. Because in the book itself, because this is from a book and into a movie, in the book itself, he also mentioned a lot about rehearsing in your head, because every day he has to wait for this speech therapist to come with the tablet, and then he has to really, the night before, or like, you know, in the morning, he has to formulate what I wanted to say, and I have to spell all this word in my head to make sure that it doesn't go wrong. And so it's a lot about talking with yourself as well. So like, it's a communication within and outside to the surroundings.
The various ways of how we communicate is really fascinating. And we began our conversation about meaning making, and within the art world, there are many forms of expressions, including the visual, dance, sound, smell, but primarily visual and written works. I went to an exhibition last year, I think, that highlighted how we perceived and experienced certain colors very differently, such as color blindness and synesthesia. And I speak for myself now, that I realized that the art world is really focused on these kind of mainstream experiences.
I think it's also a lot to do with care. I think more and more I look into the concept of care in my artwork. I mean, of course, it's a very trendy topic these days, especially in the Western countries. But then I think a lot of time is about care in the ecology of the art production as well. So like, how do you not only through your artwork talk about the concept of, you know, caretaking and showing care to different communities in society, but then how do you already, you know, perform this care while you're producing your work? And a lot of time is about giving credits or like being respect to coworkers and being transparent with your, you know, institutions and curators and people like that. So I feel like I consider more and more this element crucial in my work, to think of who am I working with and how am I, or even the material itself, is my collaborators, let's say the text materials to the images, and how do I give enough care to all this thing. And that's why maybe it makes my production process always a super slow and very slow paced and really a complicated constellation of everything, because I see them all connected to each other.
Let's continue to talk about your project a little bit more, Through the Glass Darkly, specifically about the color that you have used. Listeners can't see it, but I will post a link to your work on this podcast description and on the Last Supper website as well. But can you talk a little bit more about the color choice of this work?
Actually, so it has to go into another aspect of my work, because a part of all the research and language textual based projects, another part of my practice is with printmaking. So I do lithography, stone print, and photography. I don't know how it's called in English. It's like polymer plate. So it's like a variation of letterpress, let's say. It has the quality of doing letterpress. So I have a printmaking practice, and I really like to include printed materials in all my projects. I just really like this idea of how knowledge is being, as I said in the beginning, like how meaning is made and who has access to meaning. So in a way, I also feel like every printed materials that I do is a contribution to, you know, making meaning, disseminating knowledge and contributing to this knowledge circulation. So I really like this idea of having printed materials. So that's why I look into printmaking. And I also really like this physical form of, you know, having everything to be done by myself instead of digitally printed out. And I like the idea of things being erased and reproduced at the same time. I think it's the beauty of printmaking. And so that's why for this project, going back to this blue, is that before this project ended up in the form it is now as a soundscape installation, the initial idea is to print a set of cyanotypes, so like this blueprint, because the idea of the work, because it has this inspiration from the diving bear and the butterfly, and the other stories, which I didn't mention just now, is about the monarch butterfly. It's a phenomenon where this butterfly migrates through 1,000 kilometers, and it goes through 4 generations. So that's why I have this idea of the living things that are in the sky, and also diving bell as another metaphor for, you know, underwater existence. And so there's this subtle idea of having a color for the sky and the sea. So I ended up choosing a blue, and I wanted to print a set of cyanotypes where on top there will be graphics or like excerpts from the libretto that I print on this. Actually, there is the cyanotypes in the setup, because apart from the blue lighting design that we have in the whole space, the floor is halfly covered by, part is a blue plastic vinyl flooring, and the other part is aluminium foil flooring. So actually under the blue vinyl flooring, I put all the cyanotypes, so they become somehow cancelled out, like the blue is cancelled out by the blue. And people can, if they take a detailed look on the floor, they see all these prints. And on top there is excerpts of the script of the text that they hear from the speakers as well. So the idea is that I have this cyanotype. And I remember talking with some friends about this project. I was struggling whether I should keep all this prints in the presentation, because somehow I know that with all my other projects is so heavily text-based, and maybe it's demanding for audiences, especially it also brings out the problem of, you know, literacy as a prerequisite if you wanted to understand something. So like if I have text, it means that you have to understand the language, it means that you have to know English. And more and more I start to feel like I don't want to depend on it to be more accessible for people. I mean, even though with the voices, they are speaking in English, but I believe in this quality of the sound where, when we talked just now, like if you don't understand Cantonese, but at least from the emotions, from the way they speak, you can understand a bit the emotions and what they're trying to say or you can feel something that is nonverbal. So that's why I was thinking about not doing print anymore for this project. And I was struggling because I somehow couldn't let go of this idea of, you know, I really like to have printed works and I really enjoy doing printmaking, but how am I gonna show them it as part of the installation? And I remember someone was talking to me and we were thinking, well, actually, you are already doing a print in another format, because at that time I already had this idea that I want the whole space to be filled with blue light, different shades of blue. And we know that the soundscapes will be full of voices, full of this libretto speaking by other people. And in a way, it is already like a cyanotype in physical form. So you are actually, as an audience, you walk into a cyanotype print itself. You go into a blue space. And then you hear all this text, you hear all these voices from the speaker. It's just that you don't see it visually. So that's why I was thinking, wow, it's a very poetic and beautiful way of interpreting what I wanted to do with the cyanotypes in the beginning. And yeah, so that's why I keep this idea of having the blue and with the text flowing around in the air. And it feels like a giant poetic cyanotype.
And what else are you currently working on, Serene?
Well, there are some things that are cooking in my head, but it takes always for me so long to actually pin down something that I really want to do. But I tend to read a lot of materials and, you know, organize a lot of things and see what comes up during the process. But I was actually, last month when I was in Seoul for a residency, I have been starting to think of the idea of literacy as a tool of power. And I look into the idea of Korean language, the Hangul, because one thing that really strikes me is that I went into this Hangul Museum, National Hangul Museum in Seoul, because before I went there, I was already fascinated by, wow, they even have a museum for the writing language. They even have a museum for the language that is, well, somehow it's liberated from the Chinese Han character, because for a lot of Asian countries, we know that the language originates from the Chinese Han characters, like Japanese and Vietnamese and stuff. But then somehow Korean is the modern Korean language is the only language that is fully liberated from the Chinese characters. And it was the only invented language in the Asian countries, because other language, let's say the Chinese characters, is always, you don't really know how it's invented, right? So we have this saying that Chang Qie, this the guy who one day received this message, like channeling from the other worldly spirits, that he knows all this, you know, strokes and graphics of, you know, how do you make up a Chinese characters. But then Korean language, as I research, is that this is the only human invented, and there's a full system behind the whole language. And I found it really fascinating, and I went into this Hangul Museum. I went actually multiple times, and I found it even more interesting than contemporary art museums. But I think one thing that really impressed me, or like interested me, is that because all of the Asians' documents, or like all the artifacts that they have from Joseon Dynasty, they are written in Chinese characters. So as a foreigner who can read Chinese characters, who went into the museum, and every time I go, there's this local families or like local visitors as well. And I am the only one actually who can comprehend what they're saying. Like I can read all these materials in Chinese characters and I can fully understand what the scripts are saying. But then for the local families, they don't even know what they're saying. And I feel like, wow, it's so funny as a stranger to this country. And I go into a historical museum and it's actually me who understand your history than the people who actually is born and raised in Korea. And I find this idea just keeps in my head for some time. And I start to think of the idea of literacy and, you know, also the proximity of cultural identity. And I hope I can, you know, expand a bit more on this idea. And language as a barrier or as a border division, how do you see linguistic border, and how do you connect, language with people's cultural identity, let's say. Thank you.
we again have arrived almost at the end of this podcast, and I would like to ask you the last question about your Last Supper. If you were to have your Last Supper, who would you invite and what would you talk about at your final meal?
Well, give me 1 minute because I knew this coming, but I just somehow, I'm not prepared for it. No, actually, like, to be honest, the first instinct is that I wanted to be with myself. I feel like if this is the Last Supper, or actually, I always prefer to eat on my own. It's not only the Last Supper. I have this conversation with a friend the other day where he used to work in the environment that he worked. They would cook meals together. And every day is like a roster where they cook for the whole team to eat. And I was, my first response just, no, I don't want, because like if it's a lunch or a dinner, I prefer to be quiet, or like if I have this, you know, luxury to enjoy 1 hour of a meal time, I normally would like to spend it on my own. I'm not a very social person, because when I eat, either I can only focus on eating or I can only focus on talking. So that's why I think, yeah, maybe I would keep it this way. I would like to spend a day with someone else, maybe. But then if it's a meal situation, a meal setting, if I have to eat, then I would like to be on my own. And I would like to reflect on, I don't know, whatever I was thinking in my head. And I prioritize silence so much.
Many thanks, Serene, for coming over, and enjoy the rest of your time in Hong Kong before you return to the Netherlands.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode with artist Serene Hui. If you like the show about art in Asia, you can support us by giving this podcast a star rating and subscribing to it. More information about each episode can be found in this podcast description and on the website www.thelastsupper.asia. And before you go, you can follow The Last Supper on Instagram at thelastsupper.asia. And also, if you have any questions, suggestions and new subjects about art in Asia, feel free to contact me on Instagram or on my website www.thelastsupper.asia.